This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
It's a privilege that we're going to be able to hear from Mark Zandi, the chief economist of Moody Analytics. To introduce Mark, I'm happy to introduce John Phelan, the Vice President of Development Specialists, Inc. and DSI Civic. And John, please come up here if you like and introduce Mark, and then we'll go from there.
Good afternoon. I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Mark Zandi. Mark founded Economy.com in 1990 as a consulting economic firm on behalf of state and local governments as well as the federal government. And in 2005, Economy.com was acquired by Moody's Investors Service, and it's now a separate but affiliated company of Moody's Investment Services, where he serves as Jack mentioned, the chief economist. And I worked with Mark when I first became the budget director and chief operating officer of the state of Illinois. And unlike a lot of economists, he isn't just behind the desk, but he's very much in the front line. And I was reminded this morning when we first started working together what Scott Patterson said about Minnesota having a 3M problem, Medicaid. And Illinois then and now had a P3 problem. And it wasn't public-private partnerships. It was pensions, which we very much see in play here today. But very often, I think governments are criticized for being rosy on the government side, and a really valuable thing that Mark's firm has provided to many governments throughout the country, including in my experience, was not just a bunch of economic data, but actually would do a revenue forecast for us and gave us a real third-party reference to do so. And using that, Illinois, every year when we work with Mark, actually exceeded the revenue forecast as a result of having really a thorough outlook by an independent third party in doing that. Mark has had a lot of adventures in his life and wasn't just behind the desk. One of them was as a senior advisor in economics to Senator John McCain in 2008. So when I first heard that, I thought, well, Mark is probably the only Republican I know who's actually optimistic on the economy. But he kindly corrected me and said, no, I am a Democrat. So clearly he is optimistic on the economy. Anyway, Mark recently completed his third book called Paying the Price, which is a outlook on the monetary and fiscal response to the Great Recession, where he concludes that it really has put the economy on stronger footing. And as I said before, he is optimistic on the future of the U.S. economy. Mark is a frequent testifier before Congress, painfully, and is also a frequent guest on CNBC, NPR, CNN, as well as Meet the Press, often talking about the economic outlook for the country as well as states, fiscal challenges, the effects of stimulus, and also the mortgage foreclosure crisis in our country. Mark's degrees, including his PhD, are from the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, and I'm very pleased to introduce a good colleague and friend, Mark Zandi.
Thank you, John. Thanks for the kind introduction. I want to thank the Institute for the opportunity to be here today. And I should say, I started the company back in 1990 with a good friend, colleague, a fellow named Paul Getman, and Karen Getman is in the audience. So, and I know a lot of you know Karen. She's on the board of this institute. So, and also my brother. We should give him a little bit of credit, too. So it was the three of us. We were literally in Paul's condominium, the three of us, doing John's forecast. I can remember Paul would get really mad at me, actually more at Carl, my brother, because this was, you know, 1990. This is now, that's a long time ago. But we used to punch holes in papers to put reports together, so we'd have these punch holes, and he'd find all these little punch hole things in his bed, you know, and he'd get very angry at that. So those were good memories. So you should know, I did. Paul and I sold our company to Moody's almost 6 years ago. So it's important for you to realize that none of this is my fault. I had nothing to do with any of it. Yeah. So I think I'll spend maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes, give you my kind of take on things, and then we'll have a few minutes for your questions and comments. Let me begin by saying that the economic recovery, which is just a little over 3 years old, is struggling. Growth has slowed, but I'm confident that the recovery will remain intact. It's going to be a bit of a slog for the next 6 to 12 months. So we have to get through a number of fiscal issues, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a minute. So I don't think we're going to go anywhere fast until we get to the other side of addressing those issues. But I do think the economic recovery will remain intact, and I think it will gain traction as we approach the mid part of the decade. Just to give you some numbers to make that more concrete, GDP, the value of all the things that we produce, has been growing about 2%. Since the recovery began, a little over 2%. That's consistent with a couple million jobs per annum. And since job growth resumed back 2.5 years ago, that's about the rate of job growth we've been getting. That's just about enough to maintain a stable rate of unemployment. And, of course, the unemployment rate nationwide is just over 8%, and thus it feels a little bit disconcerting when you have such a high rate of unemployment. Interestingly enough, California is kind of kicking in to a higher gear, particularly here in the Bay Area, doing a bit better. So nationwide, that 2 million, the 2 million in jobs, that translates into year-over-year job growth of about 1.5%. California job growth now is closer to 2%, and Bay Area job growth is closer to 3%. So it's one of the stronger economies. I don't know if it feels like that, like it to you guys, but it is stronger here. A lot of it tech related. As I said, I don't think we go anywhere fast in the next 6 to 12 months, but I do think as we make our way to this time next year, when you reconvene, say, a year from now, certainly when we get into 2014-15, I think growth will improve quite significantly. And I suspect by 2014-15, GDP, which is now 2%, will be roughly double that, closer to 4%. Instead of 2 million jobs a year, we'll be creating closer to 3 million, and that'll be enough to bring down unemployment. And I expect the unemployment rate to be pretty close to what you might consider to be full employment. That would be an unemployment rate somewhere between 5.5% and 6% by early 2016. In fact, here's an intrepid forecast for you. On March 3rd, 2016, the unemployment rate will be at full employment. No one write that down, please. In fact, if you want the time of day, you'll have to buy my book. You'll have to buy my book. Yeah. Now, to get to this this optimistic outlook, we need to find the missing link, and I only have one slide that I want to show you, but I think this is key to understanding where we are and how we're going to get to where I think we're going to go. The key missing link in our economy is hiring. Interestingly enough, and you can see that here, this shows the number of hires that are done each and every month. From January of 2005, that's the first month that's shown in the chart, and I'm showing it all the way through the latest data point, which is July of 2012. And if you go back before the recession, back in 05, 06, 07, you can see that monthly job growth was somewhere close to 5.5 million. And I drew kind of a line so it makes it easier to see. To be precise, it's 5.25 million. That's the number of hires that occur in that were occurring in our economy each and every month in that period. You can see the recession, it slid, not surprisingly. And then a little bit of improvement since the depth of the recession, but not a lot of improvement. The current rate of hiring is about 4.25 million jobs per month. So there's a hiring shortfall of about a million jobs per month. Now, you may be asking, well, how can we create any jobs at all if hiring is so much lower than it was prior to the recession? The reason is that layoffs are also incredibly low. In fact, they're at record low levels. If you look at the number of people that are losing their jobs, it's about as low as it's been in the data that we have. So businesses are comfortable with their current workforce, but they're just not confident enough to kind of step up and hire more people. So to see a stronger economy, we have to see this chart improve. We have to see more hiring. Now, a couple of other interesting data points. The shortfall in hiring is evident across almost every industry. There are two industries where the hiring rates are back to their pre-recession levels. You want to guess what those two are? Energy is one. Who said that? Okay, if you give me your card, I'll give you my book. I'll give you a copy of my book. Okay, all right. Deal. Anyone want to guess what the second one is?
Healthcare.
Who said healthcare? Yeah, that's right. There's do not. If you want a book, give me a card. If I keep giving out books, it'll be worth about a nickel, in a week or so. But those are the two. Other than that, across every industry, very similar kind of picture is the one I'm showing here for the total declines. The other interesting thing is that if you look across size of business, the decline in hiring is evident from the smallest establishments to the biggest establishments, from the Moody's of the world to the startup companies. It's down pretty much across the board. But the biggest decline in hiring is in companies that are between 50 employees and 250 employees. That's where the most pronounced weakening is. The biggest guys, there's been a decline, but it's not been quite as pronounced. My point is that this kind of hiring shortfall is pretty broad-based across industries, across establishments. Oh, the other thing is regionally. It's evident across the country. And there's been a bit more of a shortfall in hiring in the South and in the West compared to the Northeast and the Midwest. I'm looking really hard at the data. It's pretty much across the board. So what's going on? Why the hiring shortfall? And I'm sure there are a lot of reasons, but let me mention three. The first is, and this is a reason for some optimism, is the construction cycle, real estate, the housing bust, and commercial real estate as well has been killed in this recent downturn. And housing is, as you know, being in California in the Bay Area, central to almost everything. Given the bust, it's crushed construction, a lot of manufacturing activities related to housing, a lot of transportation, distribution, retailing. I mean, think about Home Depot and Lowe's and furniture stores, personal services, landscaping to cable hookup. All kinds of things have been hurt pretty badly. And a lot of smaller businesses, establishments, are tied to the construction cycle, real estate more broadly. The reason this is reason for some optimism is the construction cycle is obviously turning, right? I mean, I'm sure you can sense it here in the Bay Area. House prices are now rising. Construction levels are incredibly low by historical standards. And the problem in a year or two is in most of the country isn't going to be vacant space. It's going to be a lack of inventory. And so we're going to see construction really begin to ramp up and pick up, commercial real estate as well. And that's going to give us a lot of juice, particularly as we move into 2014 and 15 in terms of jobs. The second reason for the hiring shortfall is more idiosyncratic, kind of industry by industry. For example, financial regulatory reform is weighing on hiring in financial services, particularly community banks and smaller banking institutions, but even B of A, you know, obviously has not been hiring. And that's because financial regulatory reform has lowered the returns in banking. The banks have to capitalize to a higher level. It's forcing a restructuring of the industry, and therefore hiring rates are low. Technology is having an impact. The internet, more specifically, it's just crushing certain business models, like the newspaper industry is just getting completely hammered. The retail sector also, hiring is much lower in the retailing sector because of e-commerce. It's, you know, doing a lot of damage to a lot of business models. You know, Circuit City and all the electronic appliance stores are getting crushed. It's less room to be optimistic. It's unclear how that plays out. My guess is that the most significant of the impacts I just described, financial regulatory reform, the internet impacts, are probably at their apex right now. It'll become less significant going forward, but, you know, that'll still be a weight on hiring. But the third reason for the hiring shortfall, and this is the one that's most difficult to sort of get our minds around and to measure, is I'd say it's just confidence, a lack of confidence. I think businesses like you and I and most everyone are just shell-shocked from what we've been through. I'll give you an anecdote to strike that point home. It's my shark story. It involves my wife of 26 years. We're still married. Soon after we got married 26 years ago, I used the last of my student loan money. Yeah, you know, I knew she had really good financial prospects, so I was willing to use the last of my student loan money. And we went off to St. John's, which is a nice island in the Caribbean. I don't know if you guys go to Hawaii. We on the East Coast go to the Caribbean. And we got a boat, and we went out into the water and started snorkeling. And there was this, like, isthmus. That I think that's the right word, a jutty of land that comes out of the island. This was 25 years ago. St. John's has been creamed by a couple of hurricanes since then, so it's not quite as nice now. But 25 years ago, it was just unbelievable. You know, the wildlife was really nice. So I'm snorkeling around the isthmus. I get to the other side of the isthmus, and the land just goes deep into the water, and you look down, you can't see the bottom of the ocean. And I, you know, look up, and there is a shark, not 10 yards away from me. And this was, you know, I don't know what kind of shark it was, but it looked like a great white to me. I mean, it was, you know, it was beady-eyed. I can still see those eyes. And he was just laying there looking at me. So my first reaction was to suck in a mouthful of water. You know, so I was just like this. My second reaction was to look for my new wife. I couldn't find her. I didn't know where she was. So my third reaction was to swim like hell back to the boat, just hoping I'd kind of run into her somewhere along the way, looking around. I don't think this was if you could think about it, what you would exactly do. I'm sure running from a shark is a bad idea, but that's what I did. So as I approached the boat, I could see my wife had already made it to the boat. She had seen the shark before me and hightailed it out of there. Unfortunately, she hadn't told me about the shark, but, you know, yeah. But we are still happily married. So you're asking yourself, why is he telling me this story? Well, the reason is I can't snorkel or scuba dive in peace to this day. I'm looking for that damn shark. You know, everywhere I'm in the water, I'm looking around for the shark. I can't look at the fauna. And this is 26 years after the fact. Well, I think the recession, the Great Recession, what we went through, you know, that's going to be our collective shark. It's going to be really difficult to get over that because businesses, all of us, suffered near-death financial experiences, right? I mean, and you just don't forget that very quickly. So we're all really on edge. And if anything goes off script just a little bit, it's not like we pull back. It's not like businesses lay off workers. That's not what they're doing. That would be a recession. But they stop hiring. Right, and that's an easy thing to do as a business person. Laying off workers is not easy. That's painful on lots of levels. You know, it's, you know, you've been working with these people. You don't want to lay people off, and it costs money. You know, it's not a cheap thing to do. And so you don't want to do that. But not hiring people, that's an easy thing, right? So you can say, I got 10 job openings. But you go to your human resource guy and you say, or woman, you say, listen, you know, I'm not really sure about what's going on in Europe. Let's just cool it for, you know, 4, 6, 8 weeks. Let's see what goes on. Or I'm not really sure what's going to happen to my tax rate, you know, come January 1st, 2013. So let's just, you know, take it easy. Let's not hire 10 people. Let's hire 5 people. But we'll keep the jobs open. You know, there's still a job opening posting sitting there. But I'm, if someone comes down the pike that exactly fits our needs, you know, perfect educational background, has all the skills that I need, everything is perfect, I'll hire them. But unless they, you know, meet the letter of the posting, I'm not going to do it. And I think that's really what's going on here. And that gets to the point of the talk, in the title of the talk, the economic consequences of policy uncertainty. I really do think there is something to the argument that it's the uncertainty in the policy environment, and I'll tell you a little bit more about what I mean about that, that's having an impact. It is one of the key reasons why we have this hiring shortfall, why businesses just can't seem to get their groove back and go out and fully engage, get those animal spirits and really get going. Now, policy uncertainty means a lot of things, means lots of things to lots of different people. And I'm sure it's not one thing. You know, I do think regulatory policy, regulatory uncertainty is playing a bit of a role. I mean, I mentioned financial regulatory reform. I know this firsthand because I'm in the financial system and I'm dealing with this on a daily basis. So I know that. I bet you healthcare reform is having some impact. It's the smaller businesses that are sitting around that 50-employee threshold. Remember what I said about the size of businesses that aren't hiring? Because there's a big difference in how healthcare reform treats you if you're if you have less than 50 employees or more than 50 employees. And for a lot of those companies, they really don't have a human resource guy there explaining things to them. They got to figure it out themselves, and they're trying to figure it out. So I have a brother-in-law, smart guy. He's a lawyer, but he also owns a pier. He owns a restaurant on a pier in a town he grew up in, Daytona Beach, Florida. And this is you wouldn't believe it, but this thing generates a lot of cash. I mean, this pier, you know, they go and fish, and he sells hot dogs on the pier. He doesn't, but he has this business. And he has a lot of part-timers, but he's got like 40, 45 full-time equivalents. And he's trying to figure out what does healthcare reform mean to him, because whether he should expand his pier and go out and hire another 10 employees, because that might put him over the threshold. Now, he's asking me, you know, what the rules are, and I don't know. I really don't know. I said, go hire a lawyer, but the point is he's delayed his expansion of this pier, which would have hired 10 more employees, because healthcare reform may mean nothing to him, may have no impact at all, but he doesn't know that, and so he's trying to figure that out. So I think there's something to that. I think there is a lot of manufacturers, small manufacturers, are nervous about some of the environmental regulations that have been kind of put on hold. There's some big ones that are kind of sitting out there in terms of air quality, that kind of thing. I'm not making comments on the policy itself. I'm just saying that I think that's having an impact. I think there's some legal uncertainty. A lot of lawsuits. We're still trying to sort out the mess of the Great Recession and the financial panic. And, you know, all these financial institutions have got cross lawsuits going on and still trying to nail that down. So I think that's probably playing a bit of a role. But I think there are two macro, what I would call macro policy uncertainties that are hurting us really badly. One is Europe. I think Europe is a real issue, particularly for bigger companies and kind of mid-sized companies that have operations globally. They're very nervous about how Europe will play out. I suspect they're a little less nervous today than they were 6-12 months ago. And my sense is, given the policy response in Europe, the fact that the European policymakers seem to be all committed to keeping the Eurozone together, and they probably will indeed succeed doing that, that the European concerns will fade over the next year or two or three. But nonetheless, that's been pretty debilitating and scary. And the thing is, it's very difficult to handicap. It's very for most business people. They understand their business. They know the regulations and laws that apply to their daily activity. But for them to try to get a grip on what Europe means for their business, that's pretty difficult for them to do. And they just can't kind of get their minds around it. They can't handicap it. They can't attach a probability to some of these dark scenarios that could come to pass. And if you can't do that, then that's a reason to pause, particularly when you're not very confident in the first place. But the other, and this is now, I think, the most important macroeconomic uncertainty, and this is the thing that divides the world we live in today, the economy which we have today, the economy that, you know, no one really feels good about, and the one that we should and could have is our federal fiscal policy. That is a problem. There are three fiscal issues that we got to nail down. And the next president, next Congress have to do this pretty quickly once they take office. The first is the fiscal cliff. You're familiar with this. This under current law, if policymakers do nothing, tax rates go up on all of us. The Bush era tax cuts expire. And, you know, we have the payroll tax holiday expires. I don't know if you recall, but we have a 2% payroll tax holiday this year. And we get a lot of spending cuts. Sequestration, that's the automatic cuts that we agreed to as part of the Treasury debt ceiling debacle of last summer. And a lot of other emergency unemployment insurance program winds down, a whole boatload of stuff. If you add it all up, it's $725 billion. In calendar year 2013, that's 4.5% of GDP. If we don't make changes to that, we're going to go back in recession. Now, the Congressional Budget Office, CBO, that's a nonpartisan group that helps with the federal budgeting, says that it'll be a relatively mild recession if that happens. But I doubt it. I doubt it. The models they use, they're just like my models, the one I have and I built, I'm going to use a kind of an economic term. They're very linear, right? The world is much more nonlinear, particularly when we're all scared to death, you know. So, but these models can't pick up those nonlinearities. And if we go into recession, I fear it's going to be very dark because we're already spooked. We're just going to run for the bunker, and there's no policy response to that. What's the Federal Reserve going to do? It's already, you know, kind of foundering in terms of quantitative easing. And of course, fiscal policymakers by definition aren't going to do anything. So we're done. So we don't want to do, they got to nail that down. They got to scale that back, the cliff. Second thing is we've got to raise the Treasury debt ceiling again, right? I mean, you do a little bit of budget arithmetic, the debt ceiling, it becomes binding again in December. The Treasury has some accounting gimmickry it can use to get around it for a month to maybe 2.5 months. By early March, though, they run out of accounting techniques. They're going to have to do something drastic. You know, they could default on the debt. I doubt that. It's more likely they wouldn't make a Social Security payment or they wouldn't pay Medicare or whatever it would be. More likely than that, the next president probably would ignore the law and it would be a constitutional crisis at that point. But nonetheless, that's no matter how you construct it, that's a pretty dark kind of scenario. The third fiscal issue got to nail down is what I call fiscal sustainability. That is, the next president and Congress have to lay out a credible path to deficit reduction over the next decade or so that results in budget deficits in the future under reasonable economic assumptions that the nation's debt to GDP ratio stabilize or actually begins to start to come down. If we don't do that, then my colleagues in the rating agency have said they're going to downgrade. Came out with a paper a couple months ago. It's one thing when one rating agency downgrades. You know, S&P downgraded last year. It's a wholly different thing if two or three downgrade, because then it creates havoc in the financial system. There will be downgrades to too-big-to-fail banks because they're backstopped by the government, so therefore their debt will get downgraded. Fannie Freddie debt will get downgraded. Federal Home Loan Bank debt will get downgraded. State and municipal governments will get their debt downgraded. And you have investment managers who have contracts with their institutional investors that say they can only invest in debt that has a certain rating. So if they all get downgraded below that threshold, then there's going to be forced selling, and that'll be messy. But more fundamentally than that, it will signal to the world and to all of us, frankly, that we're not going to solve this problem until we're absolutely forced to in the form of some fiscal crisis, which won't happen this year, next year, or the year after, but it will happen. And because we're going to remain fearful of that, it's going to be the shark, and we're not going anywhere fast. So we have to nail down these three things. So if my optimistic worldview is going to come to a pass, then I'm telling you we're going to nail this down. And I'm not going to tell you how, unless you ask, because I'm running out of time. But I think we will. I don't want to be Pollyannish about it. The risks are high that I'm wrong. And frankly, the fact that I just said that is a reason why we're not going anywhere fast right now, because everyone knows this, because the risks are high that I am wrong. But I think the odds are that we will reasonably, gracefully do this, regardless of who is the next president, just because of the political dynamics and the political constraints that will exist after the election. And I'll end this way on an optimistic note, like my book. And I promise I won't hawk my book anymore. I know that's irritating to you. But I literally, it just got published, so you can't blame me for trying to hawk it. And it's not because I want the money, because there is absolutely zero money in it. I just want you to read it. If policymakers are able to do this in a reasonably graceful way, I think our economic future is incredibly bright. We have righted a lot of the wrongs that got us into this mess. U.S. companies have done a marvelous job of reducing their cost structures and repairing their balance sheets. Their debt loads are low. American banks are highly capitalized, incredibly liquid, and willing to lend more, increasingly willing to lend more. And even American households have come a long way to reducing their debt. We still have some issues with foreclosure and student loans, but outside of that, household balance sheets are in very good shape. We are poised for very, very strong economic growth. And the surprise is going to be how well we do. And with that optimistic note, I'm going to stop and turn it back to you. I think I took my time, and if there's anything that's bothering you about what I said, I'd be happy to address it. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Recently, the Fed made a huge purchase of...
Is this a planted question?
No.
Okay.
Treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities seem like an awful large amount. Yet you didn't indicate that that was one of your concerns. So are you not concerned about inflation or the inflationary impact, possible inflationary impact of that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Did you hear it in the back? Do you want me to repeat it? He asked, would the Phillies make it to the playoffs?
They won't.
Did they win last night, by the way?
Yes.
All right. But they're still not going to make it. I'm going to watch the last 13 games, though. Very careful. You guys have a good baseball team, don't you? Damn you.
Check, check. One, two, three.
Oh, yeah, two. Yeah, all right. Sorry. I'm all National League. Sorry. I'm just National League. The question is about the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing policy. This is the policy of going out and buying long-term bonds. And they last week announced a very aggressive effort at buying bonds, open-ended. This is the third round of QE. The first two rounds were, I'm going to buy X billions of dollars over X period of Y period of time. This was, I'm going to keep buying until the economy improves. Which is really quite a statement. And then the question is, well, does that concern you? And the answer is, in the context of inflation, future inflation, the answer is no. I think this is a positive development on the margin. This isn't a panacea in any respect. It does bring down mortgage rates a bit, helps lift the equity market, the stock market, and this is helpful. I mentioned housing as key to our economic health. Bringing down mortgage rates even lower helps on the margin. There's constraints on how much this is going to help. Lots of different constraints. So it's not it's a bunt single, that kind of a thing. But it's still a positive development. I am not concerned about the inflationary effects of this simply because I do think the Federal Reserve has the tools and the willingness and ability to use those tools effectively to drain the liquidity before it becomes a significant inflationary problem. Now, having said that, my guess is that they're not going to land the inflation plane, so to speak, right on the tarmac. You know, to get this right in real time is pretty tough. So if you told me, think about my forecast, the economic forecast, that in 2014, particularly in 2015, inflation was above target. Their target is 2% inflation. If you told me we got to 2.5 or 3 at some point, I wouldn't argue with you. I say, you know, that's probably right. I don't think we go much over that because I think they will be able to execute. And if, in fact, it is 2.5-3% inflation, I think that's a risk willing to that I would be willing to take in the context of the current economic risk that we face. And I think the Federal Reserve did this for the reason that I spent most of my time on, the fiscal issues, that they're really very nervous that, you know, we get on the other side of the election and this is going to be hairy, you know, very uncomfortable. And they want to get the economy on, if they can, on a little bit more solid ground before we kind of try to navigate through that. And also give them a mechanism. Now they have a real powerful mechanism in place to push on the accelerator even more if they have to. Now, if I were king for the day, if I were on the FOMC, I would have done a couple things differently. I think they missed a couple of opportunities, but these are very tactical, not strategic. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
S&P, I understand S&P is paid by the very company whose bonds they rate. Given S&P and other rating companies' performance just before the Great Recession, can we trust S&P's rating ever again?
Moody's too, I guess.
Yeah. I thought she meant S&P. Yay. Come on, Tom. She did that very diplomatically. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Can I repeat the question? Yes, absolutely. She said, why shouldn't I blame you for this mess? No, you make an excellent point. So pretty obvious that the rating agencies got it wrong with regard to rating mortgage securities. And obviously mortgage securities, The very rapid growth in mortgage lending, which was fueled by their ability to issue mortgage securities and the good ratings on those mortgage securities, fueled the housing bubble, which was the fodder for everything that happened, the entire mess. Now, of course, the rating agencies, in all fairness, and I'm not part of the rating agency, so I don't want to be an apologist. In fact, read my book. I'm not an apologist. I'm sorry, I promised I wouldn't hawk it again. Sorry, yeah, all right. I will not do that again. I know that's irritating. But in all fairness, you know, there's a lot of blame to go around. A lot of different cogs in the wheel kind of messed up, but clearly the rating agency agencies were one of those cogs, and they messed up. So in that context, why should we trust anything they say? Well, let me say a couple things in that regard. Oh, and you did intimate that there was a conflict of interest, and that's why they screwed up. That, you know, they get paid by the folks that issue the bonds. Let me push back a little bit on that. And this is just me from my perspective, my perch. I don't think that's the case. I don't think it's because they got paid by the issuers. That's why they had the better ratings. Because the ratings are done by individuals. These individuals are professionals like you and me. They take great pride in their work and they want to be right. And they could care less if they say something that someone doesn't like. Because at the end of the day, it's their opinion, it's their reputation on the line. And there are controls within these organizations that are quite extensive in terms of trying to mitigate any conflicts of interest. The other thing I'd say is that there's conflicts of interest in everybody's business and everybody's practice, and you all have constructed mechanisms for trying to control those conflicts of interest. And I think you would argue that, you know, you do a reasonably good job at it. The other thing I'd say about conflict of interest is, if you could think of a better model to change it, so that we don't have conflicts of interest, I'm all ears. And we've thought about it. And you could say, well, why wouldn't the investors pay for the ratings? Well, frankly, would you really want a hedge fund paying a rating agency? Now government, really? You really want the government paying for it? Are you sure? Do you want the French government paying for the rating on French debt? Do you want the U.S. government paying for the rating on U.S. Treasury debt? You want to nationalize the credit rating agencies? You really want to do that? You don't think there's a conflict of interest there? I'm just saying that's a thorny issue. Now, having said that, I've often wondered why the rating agencies exist, right? You know, I'm not, I can't quite figure that out. Except I've come up with two good reasons for you. I think they're reasonably, I've thought about it long and hard and, you know, come up with two good reasons. The first is that there are significant costs in doing the work, that there's so many little teeny bonds everywhere. You know, think about all the bonds you guys issue. They're very complex. And for any one investment manager to get their mind around it and have a framework for evaluating it is very, very costly. So the rating agencies are there because of the economies of scale involved in terms of doing that work and analysis and putting on a consistent framework so it's apples to apples and people can say, oh, you know, this has one rating, this has another rating. Now, the fixed income market is evolving so that there are big companies that are developing that have the ability to spend these resources like PIMCO or BlackRock, you know, and they do their own analysis, which is great because it's just competition for the rating agencies. But that's one key reason. That's historically been a very important reason. The second is, this is just me, and I should say again, I'm going to just restipulate. I'm not part of the rating agency. Nothing I say is insider information. I'm an observer of the rating. I'm completely independent. The other reason is I think it shelters the fixed income market from legal liability because everyone can use the rating agency as a whipping boy. I don't like the rating. The investment manager can say, well, look, in my contract I said I'm going to invest in ratings that are above a certain level and not below a certain level. So it makes it much more difficult for the if things are based on ratings, it's much more difficult for the investment managers in the fixed income market more broadly to get sued. Now, you can say, is that a good thing? Well, it's good and bad. You know, maybe they should be sued, right? And that would make them better at what they do. But on the other hand, it would raise the cost of issuing debt. Could be quite significant, right? And then it makes it much more costly for everybody in this room to manage their financial affairs. So, you know, that in a sense, you know, that's the other reason for it, I think, the other key fundamental reason for it. So should I trust the rating agencies going forward? Well, let me just say, I think it's one opinion that you should factor in with all the other opinions you listen to. And you should go into thinking that these guys who make this opinion have a framework. They have that they execute in a very disciplined way. They collect good data, their decisions are based on data and on a framework. But it's an opinion. It's someone's opinion. The guy who rates U.S. Treasury debt and downgrades U.S. Treasury debt at S&P, that's one guy. Or maybe a woman. I don't know. I think it's a guy, you know, that makes that. So you have to keep that in mind. But it's one opinion. Should you trust it? Yeah, trust it as you trust any other person's informed opinion that does good, that you know you trust does reasonably good work. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question about data, actually. So getting to hiring, another place that's not hiring but firing is state and local government, and the numbers are small compared to this, and they move around a lot. I've been noticing. And I guess I'm just puzzled as someone who follows state and local government finances. I can understand why they wouldn't be hiring, especially at the state level, as revenues are improving. But why would they be cutting if revenues are improving? At the local level, things are getting worse, and so that sort of makes sense. But I just wonder, do you have confidence in these data, or do you spend time trying to figure out what's going on with maybe seasonal adjustments and those sorts of things at that level?
Yeah, you could hear that, right, in the back? Okay. What I like to do is look at data and worry about the advantages and disadvantages of different data sets. So yeah, look at it very carefully. And the one thing you should know about the employment data is that it is subject to significant revision, right? Each month, the month before and the month before that are revised because you get more information. Then once a year, it's revised 3 years back, and then it's revised again 3 years back, then again 3 years back. And so, you know, you're going to go for at least 3 years of significant data revisions to the employment data. And particularly at a regional level, if you're looking at California data or particularly San Francisco metropolitan area or Santa Clara County, that data can really get revised quite significantly. But having said that, the state and local data is pretty good. The state governments are no longer really laying off to any significant degree. And that goes to the better revenue picture, right? So revenues are growing 4 or 5% year over year. The states have done a pretty good job of reducing their cost structures, and so their fiscal situations are more balanced, in part because they pushed some of their revenues have improved, but they pushed some of the problems onto local government, right? So the state government layoffs is consistent with what you would expect given their fiscal situation. Most layoffs, all of the layoffs, are occurring at local government, and there the problems are still intense, right? I mean, property taxes, the housing market has just turned, but property taxes, as you know, lag significantly. And so it's going to be a year or two before the better housing market and house prices start to filter through in terms of property tax revenue. And the local governments are also getting creamed because the grants and aid have declined from the states. And, you know, they've been slower to reduce their cost structures than the states have for lots of different reasons. So a lot of it's K-12. So it's not a surprise that you're still seeing local government layoffs. Now, having said that, the layoffs in local government are abating, meaning if you go back 2 years ago, certainly a year ago, we were losing, I'm speaking from memory, so I don't have this exactly right, but you were losing 15-20K a month in local government. We're losing 5-10K a month. And my guess is a year from now it's going to be zero. It's going to be done. So the data is flawed, but I think it's telling a reasonably precise, accurate story with regard to what's happening. It's consistent with the budget picture, very consistent, I think, with the budget picture. Yeah, Tom.
Behaviorally, what we want to do is
can I ask one? Is he important?
No.
Really? So should we take his question? Yeah. Yeah.
No,
he's going to pay a price.
No.
Isn't that the name of my book? No, sorry.
I'll read the book. Okay, so the question is, if behaviorally we're trying to instill confidence, should we really be worried about the deficit? Because what you're saying is we run the risk that Moody's downgrades the U.S. And at the end of the day, we have a nuclear arsenal, and we're a pretty powerful place, and we want to see confidence. So the question is, does the deficit really matter? And if so, what's the point? Maybe you can go and take that deeper than what you gave me, a downgrade from Moody's, because when S&P downgraded, everybody looked at it and said, okay, so what?
Right. Good question. Yeah. Yeah. No. The point that Tom is making is that if we're trying to instill – if confidence is the issue, should we really be focused on the deficit? I mean, should we really worry about a Moody's or an S&P downgrade if we don't reduce future budget deficits, at least on paper? It's not the downgrade. That is no longer the issue. The downgrade doesn't help, you know, but what really matters is if we don't – we're now at a point – given that our debt load is twice what it was before the recession, given that our deficits are running $1 trillion a year, which is, you know, adding 6-7% to our debt load, that if we don't address it, in my view, it's an opinion, my view, that confidence will never get on solid ground, that people, businesses, consumers are going to begin to factor in the reality that at some point their tax rates are going to go up, at some point their their Medicare, their Social Security will be cut. And that's going to affect their willingness and ability to go out and spend and invest and hire. And that, you know, I wouldn't have argued that before the recession when the debt to GDP ratio was 40%. And I'm not even sure that's what's going to happen if it's today 90% and rising. But I can assure you, if we don't address this, it will be a corrosive on our ability to do this. And you know what? I'll say one other thing. We need to take this opportunity because we're not going to have too many others. The political stars are aligned now. We got to do it now because both Democrats and Republicans have leverage in this debate right now after this election. And we should take advantage of it. If we don't take advantage of it, we're taking – maybe I'm wrong. But you know what? What if I'm right? And why not we should take it – and if we do it now, it can be reasonably gracefully. We can think in a logical way about how we divvy up the cost and who's going to pay for it. That's all. That's all.
Do we have time for one more question? Jack, do you want to open it up?
Mark, I'm happy to buy your book because if it's true what you're saying, it'll reduce my monthly Valium bill. And probably it'll be a good trade-off in terms of long-term costs. But my question is this, having heard your analysis, which is an optimistic one for the future, but how much is your view the consensus view, or how much is it a deviant view among people in your business when people like me are getting emails saying, sell everything, put cash under the mattress, make sure you got your mother's gold jewelry, and wait it out. So the serious version of that question.
It sounds like he's taken two Valium pills.
The serious.
Yeah, right.
The serious version of that question really is, if there are people who disagree with you, and maybe there are, what is the nature of that disagreement? What is, you know, you look at the same numbers, presumably, and what if any is there the disagreement? What does it center on?
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. I am out of the consensus. Not for the next 6-12 months, but when I speak so optimistically about our long-term economic future, about growth in 2014-15, I represent I don't want to use the word deviant. Anyone want to look up a synonym for deviant? Right. I'm only joking. That's appropriate. I am kind of deviant. And it's not hard to be pessimistic. It's not. You know, given what we've been through and given what our challenges that we face. And given that it's so hard to handicap any of this because it's wrapped up in the political process, and when something gets wrapped up in the political process, it's very difficult to know how it's going to go. Take Europe. I mean, the Germans could bail. If I were a German taxpayer, I'm pretty angry because I'm adding up for these guys, you know, in other parts of Europe that have lived a lot easier lives than I have in terms of how much leisure they've taken. Or I'm a Greek or Spaniard and I have 25% unemployment. My kids aren't working. I can't get my Valium pill from the local pharmacy, you know? That makes me pretty angry. I'm going to bail. I'm going to do what Argentina did. I'm out of here. You know, it's very possible. Or our own fiscal situation. I mean, we're beating each other over the head, right? And, you know, people are very upset, angry, right? You know, and it's understandable. So it's not hard to construct very dark scenarios. And that's why we're not going anywhere. Because people can do that. And the thing that really makes it difficult is because, you know, it's again, these are questions that people can't really get their minds around, right? How do I handicap any of this? And who am I going to believe tells me that, oh, don't worry or I should worry? I don't know how to do that. So given, since I can't attach a probability to it, I'm going to attach a big probability to it, to this very dark scenario. You do the expected value, and I said, okay, I'm not moving, you know? It's not like I'm bailing. But I'm not moving. And that's exactly wrong. But, you know, I'm going to end this way. You know, we all forecast with a ruler. Each of our rulers is a little longer than others. You know, if I'm a trader, a bond trader, my ruler is about 5 seconds, you know. If I'm a planner for a utility, my ruler can be longer than that. Most people, I sense, you know, the average individual, The ruler is about a year, or maybe at most two. So they take the past year, and economists are the same way. You know, they're people. Their ruler may be 2 to 3 years. But they take that ruler, and that ruler is their forecast forever. Think back to 2005 and 2006. What was your ruler saying? Most people's ruler is saying, the sky's the limit. Yeah, my house price here in San Francisco feels really high, but I know it's going higher. Right? Same deal now. But the ruler's moving in the other, it was pointing in the other direction. But the ruler is always wrong. The ruler is always wrong. And the one thing I know, in the case of the United States of America, you don't bet against the United States of America. Don't. You can, but 250 years of economic history says don't do that. So I'm an economist. I look at history, and I say I wouldn't be betting against the United States of America. On that optimistic note, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.